This free program is paid for by the listener sponsors of WORT Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. If you haven't already, please consider donating online to help keep Radio of the Free alive.
Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street morning afternoon edition. Commandeering airwaves for unknown.
Excuse me, good afternoon, and welcome to A Public Affair on your listener-sponsored community radio station, WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. My name is Diane Farsetta, and I'm your host. And today on A Public Affair, we're going to talk about the fourth largest country in the world, home to the largest Muslim population in the world, which George Bush has designated a key ally in the so-called War on Terror. And Indonesia has long been important to U.S. political and military interests. Back in the 1970s, good old Henry Kissinger called Indonesia the jewel in the crown that is Southeast Asia, and that's not to mention, of course, U.S.-based multinational corporations that exploit Indonesia's labor and natural resources. But I want to welcome to the show Max Lane, who's been patiently sitting here for the past 15 minutes. As I said, his most recent book is Unfinished Nation, Indonesia Before and After Suharto, available at the $50 pledge level, or at Rainbow Books, where Max spoke last night. It's really, I think, can be described a people's history of Indonesia. Max has more than 35 years of experience in Indonesia, spanning the country's culture, politics, economic development, and foreign relations, and he's worked directly with progressive political groups in Indonesia, as well as East Timor and the Philippines, worked with renowned Indonesian author and former political prisoner Pramodio Anantatur. Welcome to A Public Affair, Max, and thanks. Thanks for joining us.
Very pleased to be here, especially with a community radio station. I think these kind of stations are a very important form of resistance against societies ending up really and truly like 1984. And certainly in Australia and Indonesia, we're all supporters of this kind of radio station there as well.
Right. There you go. Well, I want to start off with, you made the point last night in your presentation at Rainbow Bookstore that you think that international solidarity with Indonesia will become even more important over the next several years.
That's right. I mean, in the 1990s, Indonesia sort of gradually got back on the international political agenda because a movement arose against the dictatorship in Indonesia under General Suharto and against General Suharto's occupation of East Timor. But of course, soon as the dictatorship was overthrown and soon after East Timor won its independence, it's sort of gone off the international political agenda, with a lot of people thinking, oh, it's all over now, it's all okay now. It's 10 years since that's happened, and I think processes have gradually, slowly picked up during that 10 years, where more and more Indonesians are starting to build organizations to fight for a new national self-determination. National self-determination was talked a lot about before in terms of East Timor winning its national self-determination. Now I think what's in the process of arising is a movement for Indonesian national self-determination, that is winning its liberation from the domination under the international financial institutions, behind whom, of course, stand major governments, not least of which the government of the United States of America.
Right. And, you know, it's that looking back 10 years, what's happened after Suharto, 10 years ago, of course, in addition to the student movement, the labor movements, the peasant protests that came together and pushed Suharto out of power, there was also the Asian economic crisis. I'm wondering, as we're in this economic crisis that means that you need to support WRT 2562001, you know, do you see any parallels? Obviously, they were caused by very different things, but in terms of the economic impact, the social impact, the ability to potentially create some space for questioning the way things are run, do you see parallels between now and 10 years ago in Indonesia?
Well, up until now, the actual direct sort of immediate impact on the economy of the current crisis, on the Indonesian economy of the current crisis, which which has begun here and has spread. That direct impact hasn't been the same as the collapse, what was an actual collapse in Asia itself in 1997. But some things have started to unwind a little bit. The Indonesian rupiah has weakened a fair bit. Stock exchange in Indonesia has had to close down completely. I don't think it's flowed through quickly yet to the living standards of the majority of the people. But I suspect we're all in for a very long and deep recession, perhaps even 10 or 20 years long. And I think that will, maybe even permanently, but I think that will, over the next 6 months or 12 months, it will start to flow through to Indonesia. And it will have an ideological impact. Because in the past, explaining the backwardness, the failure to develop of the Indonesian economy, Indonesian people have either blamed corruption, which is a factor, but it's not the fundamental factor, or they've thought that their own government has done something wrong, because if you look around the world, other economies are doing quite well. But now with all of the world's economies in crisis, the actual question is there something wrong with the system itself? It's going to be more easy for that to be put on the agenda, I think. And because that's already something which the new groups organising have been trying to get discussion going around, that's actually the system that needs changing, I think these developments are likely to act as an accelerant for the new trade unions and peasant organisations and socialist groups that have come into being. I think it will accelerate their growth.
Mm-hmm. And again, my guest is Max Lane, a longtime scholar and solidarity activist in Indonesia and author of Unfinished Nation, Indonesia Before and After Suharto, which is available at the $50 pledge level if you give us a call, 256-2001-866-899-WORT.
Diane, we've got a few more people to thank.
Okay.
I want to thank another Mary. A second Mary has called, and this one's from outside of Madison. Thanks so much for your generous pledge, Mary. She says that picking her three favorite shows is the hard part. She loves Diane.
Thank you. I love you too.
Esty and Leia and music and many. She's got a bunch of programs that she's listed
Great.
Here. And I also want to thank this is an anonymous. Sorry, almost blew it there.
Okay. 256-2001. And
so thank you, Anonymous, for another very generous pledge.
We've had a good response so far. We're still early in the show. Keep on calling, because let's not break into the interview too much. But as we've said, WORT is down. This pledge drive is $15,000 down at this point from what it absolutely needs to raise to pay the bills. So we need you, 256-2001. I want to go back to Max Lane and talk about Indonesia. People might not realize the history and even the culture of mass movement, of mass action in Indonesia. Can you talk a little bit about that history, going back to the anti-colonial movement?
Well, Indonesia declared its independence in 1945 at the end of World War II. That declaration of independence was preceded by basically 40 years of pretty consistent mass struggle against the Dutch colonial occupiers and army. And that struggle from very early times, very, very early times, took the form of not only mass mobilization, that is strikes, occupations, mass rallies, demonstrations and so on, but also from very early on, that mass mobilization style of politics was organized through very large permanent or semi-permanent organizations. So Indonesia had one of the largest mass organizations in the world around the time of World War I. That was suppressed, of course, by the Dutch eventually. Had the first and largest communist party in Asia. It had a left-wing nationalist party led by Sukarno, one of the great Asian leaders, which also had huge memberships during the 1930s and 1940s. And then, of course, after it declared independence in 1945, it had to deal with neo-colonialism. First, the Dutch's attempt to stay in Indonesia, and then the United States' attempt to take over Indonesia's oil, there was even one point where the Seventh Fleet was on the verge of actually facilitating more or less an invasion of East Timor about 1956-1957. Mm. American pilot was shot down over Indonesia in the course of those events. That too was really resistance through a mass organization. By 1965, the various left-wing political parties, trade unions, peasant organizations, left-wing women's organization had about 20 million plus members. The left-wing women's organization, for example, the Indonesian women's movement called Gerwani, it had more than 1 million active members. So it was an extremely mobilized society. And when General Suharto came into power in 1965, the thing that he was most obsessed with, more than anything else, was eliminating mass action politics from Indonesian political culture, because it actually had become a part of the culture itself, which is the reason why he needed to organize the slaughter of at least 1 million people over about a 12-month period.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was supported by the U.S. and even the CIA giving lists of leftists to the Indonesian powers at the time.
It was very enthusiastically supported by the United States, by Great Britain, and also by Australian government. All of the Western governments were publicly enthusiastic about the slaughter that was taking place. The Australian Prime Minister at the time, for example, said something good must be happening when Reds are being killed. Hmm. That's how he reacted to the slaughter. And there were similar statements from the United States government and especially Great Britain as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think we have a caller. 256-2001 is also the... Oh, we do not. But if you do want to call and have a question or comment for my guest, Max Lane, author of Unfinished Nation, Indonesia, Before and After Suharto, you can give us a call at the same number. You can donate your support to WRT, 256-2001. We have one more person to thank.
Yeah, another person to thank. Dennis, thank you so much. Dennis just called in the previous show, but he called
in
again.
Oh, how nice.
Well, thank you. With a very generous pledge, and he's going to be going to the meet and greet tonight.
Oh, good. Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yep. So good to hear from you, Dennis.
Great.
Fellow student of mine and a wonderful human being. Thank you for calling in.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much. 256-2001, as we said. We are down right now on the pledge drive. So if you can add more on to a previous pledge, or if you've listened to WRT for a while, maybe haven't pledged, we need some first-time pledgers to come up and to help us fill that gap in our finances that we have right now. 256-2001. Talking about the left movements in Indonesia's history of political mass-based political activism, what about, how does the non-aligned movement work into that? Because that's something that's I don't know a lot about, but it's intriguing to me, the non-aligned movement and Indonesia's role.
Well, non-aligned movement, governments of so-called third world countries that were not, as the name applied, not aligned either to the Soviet Union or to United States of America in the 50s. That was facilitated by a major conference held by Indonesia in 1955, the Asia-African Conference, which brought most of those governments together, including People's Republic of China and also Vietnam at the time. But interestingly, between 1960 and 65, in the lead-up to the Western-backed overthrow of President Sukarno, he moved away from the perspective of the non-aligned movement. He put forward a new analysis of world politics, which I think could do with a little bit of reviving and applying to today's situation. Because instead of seeing the world as divided into three blocks, he began more and more to see the world divided into two blocks, which he described as the old established forces, old foe, he called them, and the new emerging forces, which he called Nephos. But it was interesting, he defined these new emerging forces as the governments of progressive third world countries, of which there were still some at that time, but also movements like the civil rights movement in the United States, the solidarity movement with the third world, but also the socialist governments that existed. He saw it divided into two, but not just the Soviet Union versus the United States, but yes, governments like that of the Soviet Union, although he had his strong criticisms of them, progressive governments in the Third World, but also the popular movements that were developing in rich countries as well as in the Third World. So, of course, he'd only just started to develop this analysis, and then he was overthrown, and as I said, 1 million of his supporters massacred. So that really brought an end to that analysis. Although in Indonesia today, people are starting to look at it again.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that's something that a lot of people around the world realize that the people, the rakyat, as you were pointing out last night, the word rakyat in Indonesian means the common people. Common people have more in common with each other across national boundaries than they do with the elites in their own country.
That's right. I think that was, you know, part of what he was trying to get at in that analysis that he developed back then.
And we do have a caller, so I want to welcome them on the air and remind others, 256-2001, to join the conversation or to support WORT. Hello, caller.
Max, the 1965 CIA-engineered slaughter of over 1 million people, I think could you go into detail on how that plan was carried out in conjunction with the waging of war in Southeast Asia at that time, and can you recommend any detailed studies of the Central Intelligence involvement? Just unbelievable. Thanks so much for your program.
Thanks for the question.
1965, if people are interested in this event that took place in September, October 1965, when a country with the largest left movement in the world outside the Soviet Union, China, was brought into the Western camp through this mass slaughter. There is a new book out called Pretext for Mass Murder by, I think, a Canadian author, actually, called by the name of John Rusa.
John Rusa, who used to live here in Madison.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
it's a very good book, which gives a very good explanation of the events leading up to those to that development. It certainly was something taking place in the context of the Cold War, and both the governments of the United States and actually, to a very large degree, also the government of Great Britain were very active in promoting and giving support to the right wing of the armed forces of Indonesia, egging them on to take some kind of military coup action against the government and the president of Indonesia, and especially the mass movement. In the end, though, I think it was basically a struggle that developed within Indonesian society itself. From way back, even in the 1920s, before Indonesia was independent, those who were struggling for independence became very quickly divided. Do we want Indonesia, when it becomes independent, to be a capitalist country integrated into the world capitalist economy, with taking the leadership of the Western countries as for granted, or do you want an Indonesia that actually attempts to exercise self-determination even after it's independent over its own affairs? And most of the people who wanted to do that came to the conclusion they could only do it if there was a socialist Indonesia. And that was a division which developed even back in the 1920s and 1930s. And it was one after independence which polarized society, not 50-50 actually, more like 80-20, and because it was more like 80-20, that the Western governments and the Indonesian army and landowner class decided in the end that the only way to, seeing that they were 20% and everyone who was heading in a socialist direction was 80%, the only way really that they could win was kill 1 million people. Mm-hmm. And certainly they were given lists by the US government, but also Great Britain. Great Britain was actually a very active player in this whole process, because it had a neo-colony itself next door, Malaysia and Singapore, and it was very scared that the radicalism that existed in Indonesia would spread to Singapore and Malaysia. So it was intervening very actively as well as the United States. But if you're interested in this, I strongly recommend this book, Pretext for Mass Murder, by John Rusa.
And I mentioned earlier that you've translated some of the works of Pramodya and Ataturk, who's a very important, not just literary figure in Indonesia, but also a political figure. I'm wondering if you could talk about him and his importance to struggle, especially groups now. Do they look to him, look to his writings for inspiration?
I think Pramodia Nantatur really, in the 1950s, was a leading novelist to write, you know, humorous sort of novels. But in the 1960s, he aligned himself more and more with the Sukarnoist left and began a big study of Indonesian history. He wanted the Indonesian people to look deeply into the reasons as to why their country wasn't developing and look beyond the surface picture. And so he engaged in a very big study of Indonesian history. Before he could complete that, he was one of about 30,000 people who were arrested in 1965. So he survived the massacres but ended up spending 15 years in prison without trial and without charges. And while in prison, he wrote in a novel form what he thought were the origins of the backward political character of the Indonesian ruling class and sort of trying to explain what the contradictions were. And in his novels, he also described the birth of the first large mass organization in Indonesia. And it's absolutely the fact that many, many young people who've become involved in radical politics have looked to those novels as to how to organize a mass organization, especially the novel called Footsteps, which I noticed was for sale at Rainbow Comedy Bookshop last night. It was on the shelves there. It was a novel which really went into a lot of detail, but in a very exciting, gripping way. What are the processes involved in building a mass organization? So I think he remains a very strong influence, mm-hmm. along with Pramodia, and then people also looking back at Sukarno's own writings, but a lot of new writing that's taking place today. I think we will see in the next 5 years quite a visible rise, even far away over here in United States of America, you will start to see and be able to recognize a challenge developing in Indonesia. I'm always a bit of an optimist anyway, but I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, within the next decade, that you have a Venezuela in the Asian region.
Mm-hmm. And that raises, as you were pointing out last night, it's obviously very exciting for those of us who support people power, but also, unfortunately, increases the tendency of the established powers to come in and try and stop that, as they are doing and have been doing in Venezuela.
At the moment, it's a sort of weird, semi-advantageous situation to the very small left. Now, you know, the left and the radical forces in Indonesia at this point are small, sort of recovering from 35 years of dictatorship and using the last 10 years to try and work out what to do and come to some understanding of society's problems. And I think that process is starting to give birth to, that 10-year-long process starting to give birth to some advances now, but they're still small. But, you know, weirdly, their smallness is what's giving them some space, because neither international forces nor the Indonesian ruling class is so arrogant, and might also say stupid, that they're sort of writing off these new groups emerging. Just young people on the sides, not going to do much, except the far right in Indonesia, mm. who tend to watch the world's developments more closely and understand what starts off small can, under circumstances and with good leadership, become big. And there you can see from their writings that they know that there is a potential danger here, but they're too small. The far right itself is too small to do anything via the state. They can send their thugs out and attack left-wing groups. You know, recently, for example, there was a launch of an Indonesian language edition of Hugo Chavez's speeches at a progressive bookshop, bit like Rainbow mm-hmm. Collective Bookshop in one of the Indonesian cities, and it was attacked by thugs. Mm. So you have these incidents. The far right's not powerful enough to do it in a systematic way that can actually stop. So they actually attacked this bookshop. The police came and arrested the bookshop owners, not the thugs. But the bookshop owners were, you know, out of the police station in 3 or 4 hours, and the next day the book's still on sale. Mm-hmm. So they can harass, but they're not strong enough at this point in time to stop. But, of course, once the movement grows, I think both from international quarters and domestically, we will see the levels of tension and conflict increase.
Right. 256-2001, and we do have a caller, so I want to welcome that caller on the air, go back to our conversation with Max Lane. Hello, caller.
Yes, hello, and thank you for taking my call. If I may just somewhat redirect the conversation or the questions, not so much with the past, but more with the present, and not so much left and right as opposed to what is helping the people vis-a-vis the big powers, in meaning doing the bidding of the big powers. And I'm thinking of a person in that ASEAN area, like former Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir, who, when the Asian crisis struck, engaged on his own in a very unorthodox way of dealing with that problem. He was castigated in Washington and the Western powers, and yet 4 or 5 years later they issued a mea culpa saying, yes, he was right. But what I find troubling is that all these other countries around it, Thailand, Korea, and even India in a lesser way, you know, all kowtow to the Washington consensus, and you don't see any leader there who stands up. Perhaps maybe even Burma in a very strange way do, but they are on a different course. But the second part of this question is, you know, when I see Indonesia through my rose-colored glasses from here, you know, I see the government not serving the people, meaning when there was this, a few years ago, they were just burning the forests to get probably the palm oil for biodiesel. And this was causing enormous environmental problems in the area. And then later on, when the tsunami struck, it was not so much even the Indonesian forces that helped as much as people and students running out to that area and helping. And lastly, there was this, and this is kind of, I think, emblematic, is when there was that oil well, which we just started overflowing with mud and swamping the whole area. And the drilling company was owned by some very high-connected people. But let me just say this. I'm not trying to take an unfair shot at Indonesia. Our own country has dropped the ball when it came to Katrina and what have you. So this is the perception I get with not dealing with the people's needs as much as, you know, dealing with some mandates from Washington and elsewhere.
Mm. Yep, thanks for that. And next.
And before you answer, let me just say thanks for the call on that. Of course, I won't call you by name because I'm not sure if I'd be using your correct name or your radio nom de guerre, but thanks so much for calling and a voice of Third World View. Mm-hmm. And a frequent WART listener and contributor.
I think you make some good points. There's of course, political elites in most of the countries of the world are all, you know, basically oriented towards their own interests and not really concerned about the interests of the people. But I think it is probably true that in the Indonesian case this is, you know, it takes a rather more crass form, because Indonesia didn't really have any kind of capitalist class or even landowning class in the 1950s and 1960s of any great worth, and nearly all of the business elite that controls Indonesia today developed only in the last 20 or so years under the dictator Suharto. So it's not even an elite. It's not a business or political elite with any long history, any long traditions. It only has a 20-year-long tradition, and the tradition is one of corruption and rip-off and the use of violence to get what they want. So it is probably one of the most backward and conservative political and business elites in the world. It has 30 years of blood-stained hands also because of its military occupation of East Timor. And that's the mentality and culture of this elite. So, and also being an elite that's developed during only a 30-year period under the watchful eye, not to mention watchful control, of US, Japanese and Western Europe-based multinational corporations managed and coordinated through the World Bank. There's even an annual meeting of all the Western governments coordinated by the World Bank specifically to oversight the Indonesian economy. I think it's also true that the government and political elite in Indonesia is particularly subordinate to the Western powers. If you go to Jakarta today and visit the ministries of finance and so on, you'll just see so many IMF appointed economic advisors basically running the country. So it is a very stark contrast between elite and common people in Indonesia, and I think it's only going to be the organization of those common people forces that can actually resolve the situation. Is there any kind of nationalist leader emerging at the moment? I think that's still, you know, a few years off as the movement organizes. Although I think if you were to ask, you know, is there a good model? Well, I don't really believe in models really, but you know, if you want to use a model in a kind of symbolic rough pointer, you know, rough guide kind of thing, I think I'd go for a Hugo Chavez rather than a Mohamed Mahathir. Why did the Western countries eventually, you know, say he was right? Because what he was doing was trying to save corporate capital in Malaysia. That's what he succeeded in doing, and that's why in the end the American Western government said he probably made some right decisions because he was able to save corporate capital. But the rich-poor gap in Malaysia has actually, under Mahathir, continued to get more. And, of course, there are positive developments in Malaysia too. After a 10-year struggle, the Malaysian Socialist Party finally forced the government to register itself, mainly after winning one member. For the first time, Malaysia now has a socialist in the national parliament from the last elections. And I think that also reflects the fact that especially Malaysian plantation workers and urban poor people, that there's also, you know, a feeling that the old answers just aren't going to meet the situation. Of course, there's a struggle to win more people to be convinced of that, but I think that is the dynamic that's already started.
Right. And 256-2001, 866-899-WORT, just about 10 minutes left. Come on, we need a few more people. Come on. 256-2001, support community radio. Where else do you hear these in-depth discussions of political movements around the world, challenging the Washington consensus, talking about the forces that shape not just the politics but the economy and how they're intertwined, challenging the elites. That's what we do best here at WORT. So give us a call, 256-2001, 866-899-WORT. Looking to the future, Indonesia will have elections next year, and some of the likely candidates include some of the most notorious military leaders like Wiranto and Prabowo. Does that mean anything? Can that mean anything? Might the elections help the military regain some of its political power in Indonesia?
I think it's very hard to predict precisely what will happen in the Indonesian elections, because you've got a system with 17 parties in the parliament now, and more than 40 parties registered, including these new, clearly very, very well financed parties, headed by General Wiranto. He's got his own party, and General Prabowo, one of the most generals most responsible for bloody repression in East Timor and Indonesia, he's got his own party. I don't know how it will all, the actual elections itself will flesh out in terms of who wins, who loses, who ends up in the new government. But I think on the other side, though, there's one thing that's very visible. More and more people will not vote this time than last time. People are more and more switched off from in an angry way with the whole electoral process. And I think the most important political developments that we'll see connected with the elections will occur in the 6 to 9 months after the elections, when the penny drops around society that... Are you allowed to swear on radio? Or not?
No, sorry.
When the penny drops and people think, my goodness, we are going to be faced with the same horrible mess and elite as the last 10 years. Without seeing anybody amongst any of the political parties with even the remotest ability even to sell themselves as a fake solution. You know, I won't use American politics as a reference.
Oh, go ahead.
There's not even somebody that people are putting their hopes in, but you know, if you go into deeper analysis, you wonder if there's really a reason to put the hopes in them. There's not even that. There's not even false hopes. There's nobody on the Indonesian political scene in which anyone amongst the common people even has false hopes in. So I think the elections will keep everyone busy for the next 6 months in Indonesia, even though people are alienated from the process. It is the process that's happening, so people will relate to it, or you know, half of the population at least will relate to it and will preoccupy people. But I think in the 6 or 9 months after the elections, when the penny drops, oh my goodness, it's them again. Mm-hmm. And there's a world economic crisis, and things are getting worse, and it's them again, them again, them again, them again. I think all the people organizing outside of the formal processes will get a lot more, start to get a much better hearing from the population.
And again, my guest is Max Lean, author of Unfinished Nation, Indonesia Before and After Suharto, which is available at the $50 pledge level, 256-2001-866-899-WORT. We do have a caller. I want to ask them to just be very brief because we have just a few minutes left in the show. But hello, caller.
Hi. Well, Indonesia has a bunch of islands, and it's really a huge island complex. And I was wondering if you could talk about what the natural resources in Indonesia, the main ones, are that arouse so much corporate interest. I worked for a company about 20 years ago that was interested in the hardwood in Borneo, which at that time had not been denuded at all. It was still largely jungle. And I wondered what the situation in Borneo was today and what its politics are.
Well, the timber in Borneo, or Kalimantan, as the Indonesians call it, is more and more and more and more and more denuded. There's no doubt about that. Also resulting in these annual fires that nobody can put out because the denuding of the forest, there's a lot of combustible material in the earth in Indonesia, and as soon as that catches fire, they just go on and on and on, and that's partly caused by this mess cutting down of the forest in Borneo. But Indonesia has just about every mineral you can imagine stretched out along this archipelago that's stretches across a distance wider than continental United States. So the mining companies from around the world, United States included, but also Australia, from every rich country has some mining activity there. And it's really turning the country into a bit of a quarry. None of the foreign corporations are interested in any kind of processing of the minerals that they dig out, or the timber, or anything. So it's not only often environmentally disastrous, it's often carried out without any occupation of health and safety conditions. Most international insurance companies won't offer insurance for any workers in Indonesia because none of the corporations' activities will fulfill the minimum standards. And in addition, there's almost no economic benefit because there's no processing of anything that's mined. The only real, quote, economic benefit, unquote, that Indonesia gets is that the government is able to get some taxes. But then the question is, how are the taxes used? Mainly to use an increasingly common term in the economic world today, bailout. It's only used to bail out failing Indonesian and foreign companies. So it's potentially this, because of the range of minerals Indonesia has, there's a lot of potential wealth there, but Indonesian people are certainly not benefiting from it at the moment.
I want to give you just a minute, Max, at the end here, just to say what is solidarity to you, and the importance of people in a country like the United States engaging in solidarity with other countries?
Well, I think solidarity between peoples in struggles is always crucial, but solidarity between peoples in oppressor countries with the people struggling against the oppression and exploitation that's coming from the oppressor country is of particular importance. It's really what not only can become a key factor in the success of struggles, but actually even in the home oppressor country, that kind of solidarity is also a key weapon against all forms of racism and chauvinism. Even racism that's related, not directly related, but building that solidarity with struggles with peoples around the world, especially in the oppressor oppressee relationship, I think is not only a necessary political thing, but from a humanist, basic humanist point of view, absolutely crucial.
Mm-hmm. Great. And again,
and long live WORT.
Thank you for listening to this free program provided by WORT Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Become a listener sponsor. Donate to WORT online at WORTFM.org or call 608-256-2001 during business hours.